Kia ora everyone. It's my pleasure to introduce our guest speaker tonight, Jan Bolwell. Jan is a noted choreographer, director, playwright and author who has worked in the arts all her career. She began in dance and physical education at Otago University, and that led her on to further studies in America and London. And she is in the Otago University Hall of Fame.
Oh!
Didn't you know that?
I didn't think you were going to mention it.
Her career took her to working for Teachers College, where she did at Victoria, wasn't it? Wellington, right. And Massey. And she's also done work in dance and arts for the Ministry of Education. She's been on Queen Elizabeth committees, giving advice, of course. Her dance work has been really extensive. In fact, she was probably one of the first to venture into bicultural dance works, working with Kerry Carr and Sunny Amy. She is known now as the director of Crow's Feet Dance Collective, which is for mature dancers, and has a whole empire because it even extends to Palmerston North. She is a writer and actor of several highly successful New Zealand plays which have toured, like Standing on My Hands, Here's Hilda, which is about her grandmother, Finding Frances Hodgkins, Dancing in the Wake, which is about Lucia Joyce, it's
James Joyce's daughter,
and this one, Milord Goffredo. So I would like to warmly welcome Jan. And let's find out all about her father and how on earth she found out all this stuff, because that's what's of interest to us, how we dig up information, but also in this instance how she's decided to present it.
Thanks, Diane.
So I'm not running backwards and forwards to the thing. I'll just bring this stuff over here. Kia ora koutou. Thank you for the invitation. I'm delighted to be here and to be able to about beginnings and why. In my case, it's sort of rather unusual, really. At the age of 48, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And the Wellington Cancer Society got in touch with me and said, we're running a creative writing course. And it's going to be taught by René. I don't know if you know René, wonderful poet and writer of fiction. So I went along to this course, and while, as Tanya said, I've had a career in the academic world, this was something new for me to be writing, and René very specifically wanted us to write about our cancer experiences. So I started, and I found that I got into a style of writing quite comfortably. It was very therapeutic for me. I wrote a piece called Off My Chest, which seemed appropriate. Anyway, when I finished writing that, René said to me, well, you can't stop now. What are you going to write next? So that's where I got onto my father, Geoffrey, because thinking about my own survival from cancer, I started to think about Dad's survival in the Second World War. And so that was really the link, the connection for me to begin writing his story. Getting basic information, I was very lucky. My father had died in 1993. I got cancer in 1998. And in the year 2000, I started to write Dad's story. Very fortunately for me, my mother was still alive. And I think she was a bit perplexed about me wanting to write this story, but she was sort of glad, too, in a way. And what I would say to you now, I'm a baby boomer. Hands up, baby boomers here. Lots of us. Well, you know, I realise, thinking about tonight, we're the last generation, probably, that really knew these men that went to the Second World War. And so it sort of rests on me as a sort of a responsibility to tell that story, because we knew these men, and very soon there's not going to be generations that knew these men. So that was another thing for me to write the story about Dad. But getting back to my mother, once I got into this, I realised that I needed to hear from her. And very fortunately for us, when Dad came back from the war, he started courting my mother. And my mother lived on a farm in North Otago. So Dad would come up to the farm. He was living in Dunedin. And they would sit in the car in the farm. And Dad would just talk. Mum said it just poured out of him. Poured out of him. And when I came to write the story and I would show my script and what I was writing to my mother, she said, "Oh, Jan, he's forgotten some of this." And Mum actually remembered more accurately some of the things that Dad had said to her. And one of the reasons he'd forgotten was because he was a great man to go to the RSA. So that's where the men talked. And they boozed. And how did they booze? So that's where a lot of the stories happen, but it's also where a lot of the myths got created. Because as these men aged, the stories grew. So I'm talking about unreliable information now. Yeah? And so my mother was a check on some of that, you know. Mum would say, "No, that didn't happen. That wasn't right." But anyway, getting back to how I got the initial information about Dad, this is related to the RSA. Because he would meet there and with his mates, and Dad would tell his survival story, and he was a good storyteller. So one night, he was in the 20th Battalion, some of his mates, I think I've got a slide of them actually, there they are, as young men, D Company, 20th Battalion. One night, they decided that they were going to get Jeff's story. So this was in the days of cassette tape recorders. All right. So they got him nicely. Then they sat him down, and they started talking to him and asking him questions. Underneath his chair was the cassette tape recorder. So they got the story. Then the story on the cassette tape recorder was given to, there was an outfit, I don't think they still exist, it was the Prisoner of War magazine that came out very regularly after the Second World War, the POW magazine. So it got edited and written up and it appeared in one of the POW magazines. So there was a story all written up. So in a way that became my starting point, having that story. Even though, as my mother warned me, it may not have been that reliable, some of it. So, what happened, I want to talk a little bit about turning it into a play. So, this was the book, and Tanya has got a copy of it. By the way, it's out of print. I only got 500 copies made of it, and they've long gone. But it is available on ebook if anyone wants to look at it. So, this is the book that was put out by Steele Roberts about Dad, and I wrote it as a story. Then a friend of mine who was in the theatre was, she said, "Well, it should be on the stage, Jan." I said, "What? I've just written a book." And I was a dancer. I wasn't an actor. Anyway, I got talked into creating it as a solo play. And I was so terrified about that that I said to Ralph McAllister, who was my director, I said, "Well, can't I just stand at the lectern and just say it?" Oh, he said, "That's one way of doing it, Jan." You know, looking at me as if I was nuts. Anyway, Ralph took this book and he said, "Right, we'll have a go at turning it into a play." So we had our, I'll never forget our first session. It wasn't in the book form, it was on A4 paper. And I turned it over and all I could see was a line put through page after page after page. And I said, "What's left, Ralph?" He said, "The play, Jan." And so what he had left was, because I'd written it with dialogue, not just description, so we ended up with what was left. A lot of it went. And I turned it into this play. And so in the year 2000, 2001, I started to do this play about my father. So I'm not going to do the play. Can't remember it anyway. But I am going to read you the opening scene which will give you a bit of a picture of how this all came about. And I think one of the things that I started with was childhood memories. And, you know, I'm sure you have this, where you sat around flap ears listening to adults talking. Well, we listened to them talking, and I thought, that's where I need to start. I need to start with what I remembered as a child. So here's the opening scene. I'll take my jacket off, in case I get carried away. Okay. The partying that takes place in the years immediately following the Second World War is fierce and frequent. My father and his mates are making up for lost time, deadening terrible wartime memories with booze and darts. As the years go by, stories of their exploits are released from reality and accuracy through constant retelling. Mythologies grow, and many lies are tolerated. They allow these men to become the heroes they imagined they were, and painfully are not. The dartboard in our kitchen and the social gatherings it invites has a relatively short life. One morning, after a particularly loud and raucous session, my mother takes action. Being confronted for the umpteenth time by the stench of stale beer and cigarette smoke in her kitchen, she explodes. She wrenches the offending object off the wall, marches outside, grabs the long-handled axe, and begins a frenzied attack of bashing and chopping. Hearing the commotion, my two sisters and I are amazed. I mean, we've seen Mum, ex-phys ed teacher, stretched athletically up ladders painting our bedrooms. We've seen her in the rain, bedecked in a shower cap and one of our father's butcher's coats, gardening stoically. But wielding a long-handled axe in a state of total fury? This is something new. The dartboard is made of special composition timber, which the axe has difficulty penetrating. Eager to compete, it keeps springing up out of the ground to meet her. But she wins. Axe slung over her shoulder, she strides triumphantly towards the rubbish bin, dangling the mangled object behind her. But my mother has a much greater tolerance for the boozy storytelling sessions that take place at our crib in Alexandra during the long summer holidays. "Sun's over the yard, arm," announces Geoffrey. Peters of beer emerge from the fridge. "To the four winds, Russ," as yet another top is thrown on the lawn, to be gathered up later by the girls, as my sisters and I are collectively known. Sprawled out on the grass, we listen to Dad, Russ Edwards, Elby Lamb, Hoot Gibson and Ralph Willicks fight the Second World War all over again. And again. And again. We'd had our guts full of going into battle without tank support. Thank God, Tiny Freiburg put his foot down and demanded we have our own tank corps. Yeah, good bloke, all right. Good with them, men. Didn't matter who you were. Hey! Bowell, do you remember that dust-up about us refusing to salute the British officers? Jesus, what a carry-on. And Tiny's reply? Well, if you wave to them, they'll probably wave back. That was a bloody mute! Fix those pommy bastards. Now, Kippenberger, he was a true soldier. You know, he always put our safety before his own. Too right, Jeff. Brave bugger, took some bloody great risks in the field. Won the DSO in Crete. Do you remember that time Kip got wounded at City Reseg? He was lucky to come out of that one alive. Yeah, nearly copped it in Italy as well. Lost both feet in a landmine. Right near the end of the war. For Christ's sake, Bowell, I'm as dry as a wooden god. To the four winds, Russ! Now, I'm telling you, if we'd had tank support, we'd have bloody held Bell Hammond, you know. Christ! Rommel wouldn't have known what had hit him. But I know, beyond a shadow of doubt, that in the North African desert, my father fought and defeated Field Marshal Erwin Rommel single-handedly. So that was my start. That was the beginning. And those conversations, you know, we would lie on the grass and listen to these men. And they did fight that war over and over and over again. So I began with that information. But then, of course, I had to go beyond that. And one of the things that made this story possible for me to tell was, as a young woman in my early 20s, after I'd finished university, I did my OE, as we all did in those days, and with a friend, I went to Italy. And this is where I was going to find out, I hoped, the story of my father. Because what happened was that, I don't know if any of you have heard of Bill Hammett, it was a Second World War disaster on the scale of Passchendaele. The 20th Battalion, which Dad was in, was practically wiped out. So it was a terrible battle. And you won't be surprised to know that I couldn't get Dad to talk about that battle. I never heard him talk about that. All he did was talk silly buggers like, I fought Rommel in the desert. Just Rommel and me, you know. So we always got all the funny stories. We never got the real stories. So when I came to do the play, the first time I did this play in 2000, I had nothing in that play about Bill Hammett, about what happened in the Libyan desert, because I didn't know. So you see, things have to evolve and grow. And in the second version, which I did last year at Circa Theatre, Bill Hammett is in that play. And the reason it's in that play was because one of our eminent military historians, Chris Pugsley, wrote this book, which is like a definitive history of the New Zealanders in the Second World War. Beautifully illustrated, wonderfully written. And Chris, who just lives up the road from me, which is very handy, Chris has got a whole chapter in here on what happened in Libya. And so I read this chapter, and then I had to turn that chapter into something which would happen in a play. And later, when we show you a couple of wee movie clips, I actually do the Battle of Bill Hammett as a theatrical thing. So, you know, that's why history has to keep being written all the time. Because there was information here. And, of course, historically, a lot of the information that Chris accesses here, you couldn't have got 20 years ago. Because there's a caveat, as you'll know, on information, you know, 50 years, 100 years, whatever, before you're allowed to access that information. And there's probably stuff that Chris hasn't got in here that eventually will be known as well. So any of you who are looking at New Zealand in the Second World War, I do recommend this book. It is terrific. And there's a wonderful reference section at the back and terrific photographs. So
what's it called again?
It's called A Bloody Road Home. World War II and New Zealand's heroic 2nd Division. They were known as the 2nd Division.
Christopher Pugsley.
He's one of our most eminent military historians. But this is I brought it up because it's just a super reference for that, that area. So, getting back to Dad's story. So, Bill Hammett, I found out a lot about it. But of course, I already knew through family tales that I didn't know how he got to Italy after he was captured at Bill Hammett, but I know he got to Italy, and I know that he was in a prisoner of war camp up there for 2 years in the north of Italy. And it was known as Campo 52, and that's another interesting thing, because those camps, now there's a lot of Italians, younger Italians, who are researching the story. There were hundreds of those camps around northern Italy, and many thousands of New Zealanders were in those camps. So there's another story to be told. Now, I wanted to track down Campo 52 when I started to do this new version of the play. The only book I could find was written by an Italian, but I got it, because up the coast from me in Waikanae is a colleague, Tiziana Stotto, who comes from northern Italy. I got the book to Tiziana and I said, this is a book about Campo 52. I said, I can't read it, obviously, I don't read Italian. can you give me any significant information in this book? So Tiziana read it, and she said, you know, I think the most useful information for you might come from one of the references in this book. And the reference was a book written in 1945 by an Australian soldier who happened to have been at Campo 52. And she was right. I got in touch with a rare book outfit in Australia. They tracked down this book, and I was so amazed when I got it. It was just slender, and it had brown wrapping paper around it. It didn't even have a cover. It just was in a brown wrapper. But it was gold. Absolute gold. And there's a continuation to that story, which I'll tell you in a little bit. So, getting back to Dad, what happened to him? He was in this, he was sent to this prisoner of war camp in northern Italy. And one terrible fact that I discovered in Chris's book, I never asked Dad or found out, read anything about how the men got from Libya to northern Italy. How did they get there? Well, they got there on Italian ships because the Italians were fighting with the Germans. So to get them to Italy, they were on these Italian ships. And what did the Allies do? Bomb them. Bomb them. And, you know, Dad had nightmares right to the end of his life, and I've got this theory that he'd have been on one of those boats, there was terrible loss of life. And isn't it awful to think that it was your own side that was causing that suffering? But they didn't know. The boats were full of, you know, prisoners of war. And that's something that Chris talks about in there. Anyway, he gets to Campo 52 in northern Italy, and he's there for 2 years. And in those 2 years, those Kiwi soldiers are used to make roads in the Dolomite Mountains. They were into hard labour, that's what they did. And the chap that ran Dad's camp, Dad, one of the few things he said, oh, he was a nasty bugger, Jan. He was a nasty bugger. So he was probably very cruel. Anyway, the change happened in September 1943 with the signing of the armistice, which is when the Italians capitulated. Now, what were they going to do with all these thousands of men in these camps? So the Germans, of course, were all over the place in northern Italy after the armistice. So they put these Kiwi soldiers in cattle cars, and they were sending them through to Austria and Germany. They were going to be in prisoner of war camps in Austria and in Germany. So Dad is on one of these cattle cars. He's in there with his mates, and they come to a stop in the middle of the night somewhere, and five of those men, including my father, decide they're going to jump. So they loosen the floorboards on the train, and they jumped. And of course they had machine guns at the end of all those carriages where the cattle cars were. So of course the guns, as soon as they saw these men jumping. Anyway, Dad got away. And in the middle of the night, they didn't have a clue where they were, of course, because they just jumped off the train. But he and another guy, they actually made their way up into the hills north of Verona. And they got to a village. And, of course, the Italians took great risks. I mean, these were just simple, you know, village folk, farmers, attending their vines. Well, they took these men in. But Dad realised that with so many Germans around, it was too dangerous to stay in that village. Because if the Germans had found them harbouring prisoners, they'd have taken all the men out. This is what they did. And they shot them. So Dad and his friend Arthur Oakes decided to move on. So off they went. And they were doing pretty well. They got as far as the Swiss border. And they got captured again. And this time they got thrown into prison. And they were in there with a whole bunch of Yugoslav partisans, really tough guys. Anyway, they were put on another train with these Yugoslavs. Well, as soon as they got on the train and they're in these cattle cars, the Yugoslavs, who are real hard guys, they started to loosen. There was a shaft at the back of the cattle car, so they started to loosen it. And The Yugoslavs jumped first, then Arthur went, and then Dad. But unfortunately, Jeffrey mistimed his jump. And he jumped just as the train was going through a tunnel. And he knocked himself out. But actually, it was good he did knock himself out. Because actually, he stayed in the tunnel. He was unconscious. And the Germans, of course, stopped the train and they were after all these guys. But they didn't think to look in the tunnel. They didn't think anyone would be so idiotic to jump as they were going through a tunnel. So when he came to, he saw a farmhouse up in the distance. So he made his way up there. But he was concussed, so he was pretty sick. Anyway, another farmhouse, they took him in. They nursed him for a couple of weeks till he got better. And then he hit the road again. He travelled at night. And he eventually made his way back to the Zantadeski family, who were the family that looked after him. He got back. So there he was, very ill. They looked, they nursed him back to health. But again, the Germans were everywhere in the area. So they just couldn't leave him in the village. So they took him way up north of the village. And he lived up there in an underground cave for 2 years. And when it was safe, they'd sometimes bring him down to the village. But essentially, that's where he lived, up in this cave. And he spoke, for the rest of his life, Dad spoke fluent Italian. How did he learn Italian? Well, the children in the village used to go up into the mountains to graze the sheep. So Jeffrey would come out of his cave, and the kids taught him Italian. That's how he learnt the language. So there he was in his cave, and then, of course, the Americans came through in April 1945, and he was liberated, but the Americans weren't too sure about this guy. Here he was in, you know, civilian clothes and speaking Italian. They didn't believe he was a Kiwi. So he was locked up with the Germans. So there he was, locked up with the Germans, but eventually... one of the Americans decided that he must be a Kiwi, so he got back. So that was Dad's story, and eventually, of course, he got back to New Zealand. Now, I didn't know, I knew some of that, and that was what was recorded on this tape that was then appeared in a POW magazine. So here's me now, in my early 20s, going on my OE, and so I'm going to go to Italy. And Dad just said to me casually one day, oh, well, since you're going up through Italy, you girls, he said, you might try and find the Zantadeschi family. I said, well, where do they live? He said, oh, I can't remember that. He said, 30 years ago, Jan, you know. So he gave me some vague instruction about where, you know, this place might be. And so we're on this Italian liner. Oh, this is the new version of the play that we did last year at Circa. And I did it with Kate Jason Smith. We did. Her mother was an Irish nurse, and she nursed in Northern Europe during the last 18 months of the war. Had an amazing story. She won the Legion d'Honneur. The French gave her this highest award, so she was quite something. So Kate told her story, and I told my story. We did it as a double bill. Oh, that way. Oh, there's Jeffrey. The beer in hand, of course, and marching. Oh, there's Rommel. So I had this picture. This is Rommel features in our family because Dad fought him single-handedly in the desert. So I've always had this thing about Rommel. Actually, he was a damn fine soldier and quite an honourable man. He committed suicide in the end, at the end of Hitler's reign. But there he is. I love that photo. I thought it was just so good. I should have Jeffrey on a tank coming the other way. That was Kippenberger. Now, Kippenberger was a wonderful man, a great soldier. And, you know, 20th Battalion were very lucky. They had Charlie Upham, who was a double VC. They had people like Kippenberger. Dad adored this man. You know, they really were heroes to them. And they led brilliantly in the war. Wonderful. So, come on, keep it the wrong way. Go. Ah, the Galileo Galilei, an Italian liner in the days when we could go to Europe by boat. Actually, it was hilarious. I do a very funny scene about being on the boat and having our officer boyfriends, you know, doing the whole thing on board. And I, in the play, I do a whole scene about this with these Italian lovers, you see. A woman came into the audience, she said, Jan, I was on that boat. She said, when did you go? This is amazing. You never know who's out there, do you? And I said, she said, who was your boyfriend? I said, Mario. She said, I was with Mario too. And what these men would do, they would stand on the deck as us young things were getting on the boat, and they'd pick out which one they were going to have. So you were earmarked before you ever got on the boat. Anyway, Mario did have his uses, I have to say.
Were they all named Mario?
I think a lot of them were. Oh, there was Tony. Yeah, Tony. Anyway, oh my God, when I think about it now. No, don't think about it. Right. So on the boat, I thought, well, they gave us Italian lessons and, you know, rudimentary. But I thought, well, okay, we're going to Italy. So I got Mario. I wrote a little paragraph about Dad's story. So I got Mario to translate that into Italian for me. So by the time I've got off the boat, I had Dad's story, you know, in a rudimentary form, in Italian, which was quite important, actually. So anyway, we get off the boat, and we're up in Verona, and I said to my friend, oh, look, Dad's given me this vague address. I said, we better try. I didn't have any thought that I was going to find anything. But I said, I need to write to him and say, at least I've tried, you know. So out of Verona, we got on this bus, and we arrived in this town of Cerna, just north of Verona. And I said, well, what are we going to do now? I said, well, look, we'll go to the taverna. You know, we'll go over there. Someone will know something. So we got into the taverna, and I had my little note, and I thrust it into the hand of a waiter. And they're all gathering around there. Buzz, 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 buzz. You know, they're all talking and talking and talking. And I said, I think something's happening here. Looking over at us. And then not long after, a young man called Pietro, local, comes into the taverna. And he says, buongiorno. He said, come with me. He had a bit of English. So we're mad, really. We got into the car with this young man. And we're in the car, and we're winding up into the mountains. And I thought, where are we going? I said, this is not a very good idea. Anyway, it's too late now. We're in the car, we're up in the mountains somewhere. Anyway, at some point, he turns off that road, and he goes down a bumpy track, and he arrives outside an old farmhouse. So I thought, oh, well, we'll see what happens. I don't know how he knew, but they obviously did. And so we get out of the car, and Terry and I are just leaning against the car, and a middle-aged woman comes out from behind the farmhouse. And Pietro goes up to her. So she's facing out, seeing the car and us. Pietro's got his back to us. He's busy talking to her. But, you know, as he's talking to her, she's not looking at him. She's looking past him, and she's staring at me, just staring at me. And, of course, it was one of the Zantedeschi women. It was Lena Zantedeschi. And she recognized me because I'm about the same age that Dad was there in the war. So she knew, just by look. I could tell the look of her face. So in we go into the farmhouse, and that's the start of a very drunken day because the best wine comes out. They toast Goffredo, then we get taken to the next place, and we meet all the Zantedeschi family. And Milord Goffredo, the reason I call the play and the book Milord Goffredo is because, you know, these were very simple peasant Italian folk. And for them, anyone who spoke English had to be a lord. So he was known as Milord Goffredo. And that's how he got the name. So when I got back to Verona, I wrote, and in these days, of course, no phones, no computers, too expensive to ring home. God, you don't do that. That's going to cost money. So I write that night, I write an aerogram to Dad, and I tell him about my day up in the mountains and meeting the Zantedeschis. And I address the envelope, Milord Goffredo.
Oh, wow.
So Mum goes to the post office when it eventually, probably 6 weeks later or God knows when, you know. When Mum goes to the letterbox, she takes out the aerogram and she looks at it and she yells to Dad, "She's found them!" And so within 8 months, my parents are on their way to Italy.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to show you some shots of... That was me with the Zandadeschi family.
Oh, wow.
And you see the little woman on the left there? Can you see she's wearing a gold cross?
Yes.
When Dad got back from the war, there were 4 Zandadeschi sisters, and Dad got gold crosses for each one of them. And that never left Marie. She always wore that gold cross. And she, you know, tried to speak to me, and me and my sort of rudimentary Italian, she kept picking it up and showing me. And the old fellow, Marino, he was the guy that looked after Dad when he jumped off the train and got back to the village. He just nursed him back to health. And he just held my hand when we went into the house. It was overwhelming, I have to tell you. And he would just hold my hand and say, Goffredo. You know, he just couldn't get enough. He just gripped my hand. I mean, you know, I'm 23 or 24, and I was so casual about this, and I'm just suddenly slammed by all this emotion from these people. I mean, it was quite extraordinary. It really was extraordinary. So there I am with the family, and this photo. Oops, so I'll go back. I'll try and go back. No, I won't. Oh,
yes, you will.
This is a photo of my parents. I'm sorry, I keep going away from the mic. This is a photo of my parents' wedding day. And the reason I've got it up there is when I went into one of the Zandadeschi homes, there was Lena, Assunta, Rosetta, and Maria. And Rosetta said to Assunta, "La fotografia, la fotografia." Oh. So she rushes away, and then she comes back into the room, and there's this object wrapped in tissue paper, yellowed with age, wrapped carefully, and it's unfolded, and this is what I look down at. So Dad had obviously sent them this wedding photo, and it wasn't out on view, it was wrapped in tissue paper, tucked away in a drawer somewhere, you know. And this telegram I want to show you, because this is what I do in the play, because I think it's a really important part of the story. My uncle, Ted, received this telegram, and this was when Jeffrey had been captured in Belhamid, and this is the only thing the family knew. This was the telegram from the Minister of Defence to say, "Much regret to inform you that your brother, 15295 Private Jeffrey Frank Bowell, has been reported missing. The Prime Minister desires me to convey to you on behalf of the government his sympathy with you in your anxiety." And it was 2.5 years before they knew whether he was alive or dead, after that telegram arrived. I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it, when you think about it? You know, what goes through your mind? I mean, his father was dead, but his mother and all his sisters and his brothers were alive. So they had no idea what had happened to him. Oops. There they are, back with the Zandadeschis. So there he is, that's Maria, and that's Dad in the middle there, and Aldo and one of the sons, and my mum. So they get over there, and they just slip into life in this Italian village. It's unbelievable. They're there for months. In fact, my mother seriously said to Dad, "Why don't we just rent a place for a year and stay?" Oh, you know. I mean, that it just, there they are by, that's Cherna. Beautiful. And that is the cave.
Oh.
That was the cave. So it was a cave where he had to clear away. But it was very narrow entrance. But Dad said once you got inside it, it was quite roomy. So every night he would have to get in there and he would gather up dry bits to make a bed. And but the thing is, before he got in there, he had to clear away the snakes, because the snakes liked it in there too, because it was nice, warm and dry. So that is where he lived. And there's a photo here with him. There he is outside his cave. And the extraordinary thing was, you know, he would walk to get food. Asunta, they would prepare a hot meal for him. So at night, in the dark, he would come down from his cave, no lights, of course, and he would have a track, and he would go down, and they would come up, great risk, because the Germans were everywhere. Asunta would come out with a hot meal. I'm sure they didn't do it every night. And she would meet him, and he would go back up to his cave. And the extraordinary thing is, when they went back, of course they're going up there in daylight to the cave, no one had to show Dad the way. He knew exactly where to go. And it was all overgrown, but Dad said, look, I walked that track every day for 2 years. You know, he just knew it. He knew the track. That's one of the sisters. That's Rosetta and her husband. And, you know, these four sisters, they're just the most wonderful women. Strong, you know, and so brave, all of them. They just took such risks for their own lives. There they are. Dad and Mum always talked about the endless love. That's the sons, and that's Asunta and Mum, and my elder sister Suzanne, who came over, and the boys, their sons. But these lunches went on for hours. You sit at the table, and that's where you were, and course after course after course. And that's, you didn't go into a living room, you sat at the table, and that's where all the discussion happened. Mum said to me, she knew it was time to come back to New Zealand when at one of these lunches, Dad turned round to tell her what they'd been talking about, and he's babbling away at her in Italian. She thought, this is no good. He had so absorbed, he was just right back into it, you know? And that it's just like the years peeled away for him, really. Now, Mum and Dad came back, and Dad here is in his late 70s, and one day he said to Mum, I mean, they'd gone when he was about 60, right, to Italy. He said, I'm going back to Italy. And by this stage, he was not a well man. And Mum said, are you, dear? He said, yes, I'm going to Italy. And, you know, at that age, he got on a plane, he just had to see them again. He had to go. So all by himself, we were terrified. You know, we kept trying to have to track him where he was. So he went back. He went back, and this was his last visit. And he didn't stay as long that time, obviously, but he just had to be with them again. It was just something compelling and that he had to do it. These are some photos. I showed some of these. These are the men. This is back to Belhamet and the New Zealand soldiers in the desert. And when I'm telling that story in the play, I use some of these, but what I want to show you in comparison, does anyone know who this artist is? McIntyre. Yeah, Peter McIntyre. And Peter was in the desert. He did the most, I mean, these are almost more visceral than the actual real photographs, you know? Extraordinary. And, you know, Peter doing this, he was right in the this wasn't done from a photo. He was right there in the middle of it. And so when I did the play, I thought, this is, again, you know, thinking about genealogy, this is, these things can be really important. To me, these are more valuable in a way than the photos, you know. So Peter got in there, and if you ever get a chance to see an exhibition of his paintings, this is what went on in Libya. This is what went on. And see these tanks here. You know, Dad always said, the reason they got captured at Belhamet was because they had no tank support. And there's this terrible thing, and Chris writes about it in his book. They're sitting up on this ridge, all these Kiwi soldiers. They've taken Belhamet, but then they're stuck because there's no one to help them. They can look down off this ridge and see all these Kiwi men being captured. And they're sitting up there. They're sitting ducks, basically. But in the distance, they see a British tank corps, and that British tank corps sits and does nothing, just looks. And, you know, Dad had always told the story, well, you know, if the POMs had bloody well supported us, you know, we had no tank support, that's why we got captured. And I thought, oh, yeah, you know, this is a bit of anti-POM feeling from Dad. But actually, it's exactly what happened. And they were bitter. The men were so... I mean, they were great soldiers, and they felt let down. Dad said they were humiliated because they took their target, they got there, they were holding Belhamid, and, of course, they had no support. So this tank thing, really, it made me think about that a lot. And there they are with the machine guns. So I think those are wonderful photos. Paintings. Now, this has got quite a story. When I wrote the play, how am I doing for time, by the way? All right.
Harry, lost track, but it's great.
Okay, nearly there. When I did the play, and this was back in 2000, the first version of the play, I was very lucky, because I was able to tour that play around New Zealand. And I had some wonderful experiences. One experience stands out to me. I was in Christchurch, and I was performing it at the Court Theatre. And unbeknownst to me... step back a bit. My mother had come down to see the play. And someone had got in touch with Burnham Military Camp, which is where Dad trained. That's where they were all gathered together. So Mum and I had the most remarkable... Someone got in touch. The leader of Burnham Camp at that time said, I want you to come out. So Mum and I went out to Burnham Military Camp. They did a march past for us. And then the commander of the camp, whatever they're called, he then addressed these young men... And he talked about Dad and why they were honouring Mum and me. I mean, it was the most extraordinary thing. And then the commander of this camp came and saw the play. He brought his grandson with him. So that was one experience that we had. But also, when I was performing in Christchurch at this occasion, a lot of my family came, which was great. I'm about to start, and these... old guys pull up in a taxi. Some of them are on frames, but they're all quite frail. They're all wearing their medals, and they bring them into the theatre. And they sit them in the front row. And so I'm playing, and I've got these men sitting in front of me, and I'm thinking, dear God, you know, am I going to get through this? So I did the play, I did my bow, and then I went up and I shook every one of them by the hand. And they were all sitting there in the front row. And it was the most extraordinary night, you know, just being there with those old soldiers. Extraordinary. And when I was playing in Wellington at Bats Theatre, I came out from the theatre one night, and there's this elderly gentleman, and he said, could you come and sit with me for a moment? I said, I surely could. And I sat down beside him, and he had a photograph album with him. And he opened up and said, I want to show you something. And he showed me these photos. And actually, his story was really a replica of Dad's. He showed me photos of his Italian family. And all these photos of the family that he'd gone back. So, you know, it's an interesting story, but it's not unique. You know? These soldiers were looked after by many, many Italians, as I said, who took, you know, great, great risks looking after these men. So the bond is just enormous. So anyway, coming back to this first, I went to Gisborne, and I'm performing the play. This is back in 2000 and something, early 2000s, and I'm about to perform the play at Lawson Fields Theatre, and I get a phone call. And there's this elderly gentleman on the phone, and he says, oh, g'day, I'm trying to find Jan Bowl. I said, you found her? He said, yeah, I've been trying to track you down. I said, well, he said, name's Doug Wilshire. I said, well, Doug, how can I help you? I jumped off the train with your father.
Oh, wow.
I said, what? I said, I jumped off the train with your father. I never did find out what happened to him. Did he stay in the butchery business? And I said, Doug, look, why don't you come to the theatre tonight and I'll tell you what happened to Geoffrey. Oh, no, Jen, I don't go to the theatre. You come round here tomorrow morning and have a cup of tea with me. So the next morning, I drive to the outskirts of Gisborne to this modest little bungalow where Doug lives alone now. And so we sit in the kitchen and we have a cup of tea out of his best bone china. And I tell him Dad's story. He says, "Strife, Jan, that's a bloody good yarn." Now, he said, "I've got something to show you. Come through with me." Well, we go through to his drawing room, living room, whatever. And this is Pride of Place over his fireplace. This is Campo 52. Mm. And he said, "This has been over my fireplace ever since I got back." And one of the men in the camp had done this cartoon version of Campo 52, and there it was on the wall. So then Doug and I sat down in front of this, and I got the story about what really happened in Campo 52, which I never got from Dad. So when I came to do the new version of the play, Doug was in it. Doug was in it. And so I replayed the scene of Doug and me meeting, and so that information, you see, it just suddenly there it all was. And I got the book from Australia, from this guy that had written about the camp, and I think there's many more stories to be told about those camps, actually. So, there he is, that's Doug and me.
Oh.
My local paper got hold of the story, and here we were, the pair of us, outside Lawson Fields. So, you know, these things, you just never know when you get out there in the world and you tell these stories, and I'm sure you feel the same about the stories that you can tell about your families. You get so much more. My story about Dad has been embellished by other people. You know, I didn't have to make it up and fictionalise it. These men actually enabled me. And so getting back to research, you know, when the war finished, every battalion, the Internal Affairs Department, whatever they were called then, every battalion had its history written up. Okay, so this one, and I haven't actually looked at this. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
This says, the 2nd New Zealand Expeditionary Force, presented to Private Geoffrey Bowell by the Government of New Zealand in recognition of his service with the 20th Battalion Armoured Regiment in the Second World War, 1939 to 1945. I guess every man got one of these books. Okay, so I read this book in preparation for doing Milord Goffredo. But actually, this alone isn't enough, because it was written practically straight after the war. And so a lot of the documentation they didn't have then. You know, it just wasn't available. And some of it would not be available for decades. And that's why Chris Pugsley's book is so important. So if you're researching things historically about this stuff, you know, it's important to look at the early stuff, but it's also so important to look at the histories that have come after. Because it's not just a replication, it's a development. Because they've been able to access, for all sorts of reasons, they've been able to access more material. So that's what happened. So, any questions? Anyone want to ask me anything? Stunned silence?
That book, is that in the Wairoa Museum? Because there
this?
Is,
my
no,
book?
No, no, the red
oh, must, this one?
Yeah, yeah,
well, surely.
Well, no,
well I don't
that,
know.
In the museum at Wairoa, there's the official version, and sort of an orangey coloured cover,
yeah.
And they've been half the size of that, and they've got on all the different groups. New
well,
Zealand
this is a battalion history.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is the 20th battalion. So I imagine the other battalions also had history. Has anyone looked at a battalion history?
Yes, I have looked at these other ones in the museum. I've actually got one because my father was in the Ordnance Corps in the islands.
Right.
And they got those back after the war, but I didn't know about that.
Well, this was published by, I'll tell you, the War History Branch, Department of Internal Affairs, Wellington, New Zealand, 1957. So they must have spent that next decade after the war writing these battalion histories. And I'm sure the 20th wasn't the only one that was written, I'm sure. So that's interesting to hear. Waiuru I did visit, and I had a very interesting time there amongst the records. And the other thing, I'm sure some of you have done this, is when you can access letters. And a lot of families have put letters into those museums, and that gives you a wonderful... But of course, you know, even with letters, there was only a certain amount that they could say. So it wasn't like they could just describe everything that was happening. It was vetted because of the security issue, you know. So look, I'm just going to finish, if our technician is there. I'm just going to show you a few little excerpts from the play that I did at Circa last year. And the first one is me enacting Dad fighting Rommel in the desert. And then the next two, they're just short, is Dad escaping off the train twice. If we can we do that? Yeah. Yeah, that's it. So it was to try and capture the feeling of that. So, you know, the story really is my return there, finding the family, Dad going back. So it had a nice cyclical feel to it, you know. And just one thing I would say at the end, you know, I had people obviously coming up to me after the show, and at this stage all the old boys have gone, of course, but people my age were there, and talking about their families. But one lovely encounter was a very young man who came up to me and he said, "How did you find out about all that information?" He said, "I want to find out about my grandfather." And his grandfather was in the war. And I said, "Well, look, here's some ideas." So I really hope that young man was stimulated enough by seeing that to go away and, like you people do some of his own family research, because there's many, many tales to be told, and there's many ways of doing it. Not everyone has to go and ponce around on the stage like I do. You know, just even getting that information for future generations, really, is why we're doing it, I think. Yeah. So thank you for being a lovely audience. I hope you found something of interest in this tonight. Thank you again for the invitation. It's been great to be here. Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you.